Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Now, back to America This Week, live with Father Matt Malone and Carrie Weber.
Welcome back. You're listening to America This Week. I am Carrie Weber, and I am joined today by Father Matt Malone and our friend and colleague Kevin Clark of America Media. And we have been talking about the refugee situation and political partisanship. And it's interesting because we have recently published an editorial that sort of gets to a little bit of what you were talking about before the break, Matt, which is this sense of being really focused sort of on our own political situation at the moment and what, and in turn, sort of what that means for our lives, sometimes, unfortunately, at the exclusion of others who are in need of our help. But a lot of people are feeling a need to act on behalf of our own political situation these days. And a lot of that seems to have come out in the form of a boycott or a protest or some such thing, the Grab Your Wallet campaign, encouraging shoppers to boycott retailers that sell Trump-branded products, etc. And so we have an editorial called "The Political Gets Personal, Partisanship and Consumerism Are a Dangerous Mix."
Yeah, or they can be. You know, there's a... there's obviously a moral dimension to all of our choices, and particularly all of our consumer choices. We're going to talk to Nathan Schneider in a minute, who has written a great deal about this. But it seemed to strike me and the other editors that they're in the world of today, so many of these choices don't just have a moral dimension that they've always had, which we should explore and seek to unpack and wrestle with, but that there's a moralistic one, right? That there's a way in which our politics has become so moralistic that it infringes on every choice that we make. And one wonders whether we have in some ways, you know, transformed some of our political symbols and into false idols, in a sense. And so, you know, does everything have to be about, we were talked about, you know, this so-called compassion fatigue at the beginning of the hour, and I think there's also probably a politics fatigue in the country.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
definitely.
I mean, it's like
people swearing off Facebook.
It's there on the Grammys. It's there. You know, do you go with Uber or do you go with Lyft? Or there's a Grab Your Wallet campaign. There's people not going to Nordstrom or flocking to Nordstrom because of the
associations. I have totally cut back
the Trump wine at Wegmans, which then was they tried to boycott the Trump wine, but then it sold out. There's a whole.
What is Wegmans? Is that a supermarket chain? Is
it Kevin? That's like, that's a bad
it
question.
Is a supermarket.
Yeah, it's a very popular supermarket chain in certain areas that have it.
And I think you know that
certain areas that have it.
Well, I don't have one here.
Yes,
they're really upstate, aren't they?
I think so. Wegmans, I don't know. Upstate. Everyone I know who lives near one is obsessed with them. Apparently,
Weggies.
They're wonderful.
They call them Weggies, don't they?
I don't know.
And as we say in this editorial, you know that the, you know, from the food we eat to the cars we drive, what we buy can and often does reflect our values. But there's also a way in which this debate about, you know, do you go with Uber or Lyft or whatever, or do we bulk boycott Walmart is a luxury for a lot of us, because, you know, a lot of people who are shopping at Walmart are just trying to get by.
To shop at their local supermarket because they're living in a part of a city that doesn't have many options. They're buying in a bodega, for instance, their daily sustenance, and paying through the nose doing that. I guess in a sense there's a lot of first worldy. I was kidding about going. I've never set foot in a Nordstrom, so I don't think my boycotting Nordstrom is going to make much difference to their bottom line. And as I understand it, that was a purely commercial decision. Her stuff wasn't selling, so Nordstrom dropped it. It wasn't they weren't trying to make a political statement.
That's kind of the point, isn't it? Like, it was interpreted
as a dig against the president.
And perhaps it was in some, who knows. Everything is filtered through that.
Exactly. Like, I bought my brother a hat from L.L. Bean for Christmas, and it says L.L. Bean on it. And then, like, he's like, I love this hat. I'm going to wear it all the time. There's no political motive in the L.L. Bean hat until President Trump tweets about L.L. Bean, and the lady, the granddaughter of L.L. Bean, tweets about Trump, and suddenly he's got to like fold the brim of his hat under so as not to talk to people about Donald Trump everywhere he goes and still keep his head warm.
Yeah,
I mean, again, this is low on the scale of suffering. But
it's real. And actually, let's bring in Nathan Schneider, who joins us on the line and is a columnist for America Magazine. Nathan, great to have you with us.
Oh, good to be in the conversation.
Nathan, you must be unable to buy anything anywhere following this logic. Do you just make your own clothes?
Well, I'm not such a purist as I think I'm perceived in writing sometimes, but there is such an incredible fatigue. One thing I've been really enjoying is a friend of mine has been organizing these repair gatherings here in Colorado. They call it the Sewing Rebellion, where people get together and just repair stuff that they have already that's broken, rather than having to buy any new stuff. And it kind of helps you bypass a lot of these problems.
Hmm. Do you realize the damage you're doing to the economy by making repairs to your clothing instead of buying new clothing?
Oh, that's a great point. Yes, that's a great point. Yeah.
But this is something that you've written a bit about for America over the years. You know, the intersection of consumerism and our politics and activism. And so, I mean, what do you make of all of this, the intersection of these things in our contemporary politics?
Well, it's so hard. Yeah, I think the points that you're bringing up resonate with this recognition. I think that we have to make that what we're dealing with is not just a question of, say, Trump or not Trump, or immigration ban or not immigration ban. We're dealing also with an attention economy. I've been kind of haunted in the last few weeks by I reread this old essay by Joan Didion about the Central Park jogger case, back in a few decades ago, famous case where a number of young men of color were arrested and accused of raping a jogger in Central Park
and convicted
and then exonerated.
Yeah.
And Donald Trump was very, very active in that effort, and was having these big, was buying these big ads in the New York newspapers saying that they should be executed immediately, and this big kind of law and order crusade, and people then in turn protested him, and there's this line that he told the New York Times and that Joan Didion quotes. Where he said, I don't mind if they picket. I like pickets. And that's so striking because, it makes you think of, for instance, like the Women's March in a different way. You know, did he like the fact that the day after his inauguration, the largest protest in U.S. history took place? In a way, I think he probably did, and that it kind of doesn't matter whether you're for or against. You're participating in that attention economy that's part of the power structure. And I think
And there's
that,
no bad attention. All attention is, right?
I mean, absolutely. Right. Yeah. And he said things to that effect, in his kind of various utterances. And again, regardless of him itself, it does, I think, ask us as Christians, where are we putting our attention? Is it Christian enough to just kind of respond to each thing as it comes, to react, or is there a kind of calling to set a different kind of agenda, to direct our attention elsewhere? That's what I've been really puzzling with lately.
And what role do you think a protest does play in setting that agenda? Because it, I imagine, could make people feel somewhat, just have their hands tied. If they participate in the protest and they're protesting Donald Trump and he likes it, they don't participate in the protest, they get criticized for not speaking up. Some people are criticized for being in the protest because they say it's just sort of like a group therapy effort. What mm-hmm. role does that actually play in making change or creating solidarity?
Well, I think we have to point out that protests shouldn't just be happening in isolation. It should be part of telling a different kind of story about what About the world that we're trying to create. You know, when you think about a boycott, for instance, you know, a lot of boycotts in American history have been totally ineffective. The ones that have been effective, you know, for instance, the Birmingham bus boycott, you know, when you talk about privilege and you talk about kind of luxury, I mean, these were people who had, you know, for whom the bus was not a luxury, it was a necessity, but right. they still maintained a year-long boycott because it was part of a broader strategy with a clear objective and it was part of a broader movement, and therefore that gave it a special meaning. And you see that over and over again. The boycotts that have been successful have been ones where people are waging them with a particular purpose in mind and in the context of a broader story that they're trying to tell about where the world should head. And I worry about the protests that are just a reaction, you know. And I think the difference is how is it that these kinds of protests, whether they're boycotts or going out in the street or whatever it is, can become part of telling a different kind of story, maybe a story that has more of the kind of divine love that we're interested in, that, you know, that we should be directing our attention to at the center of it, rather than, again, just this reaction to whatever the next tweet happens to be.
Right. Or like, because there's something addictive about that outrage, isn't there? And that there's a, so rather than it simply being a kind of ideological emotivism, right? Like how do we bear witness to a different worldview precisely
it's
as disciples?
Addictive, right? And exhausting.
Yeah.
You know, it's exhausting. And I've, you know, been covering social movements for a number of years now, and over again, I see that exhaustion, right? Especially when there's this sense, this belief of people just entering into these kinds of efforts that, oh, we just have to do this for a little while and then things will get fixed and we can go home. And they enter and then they participate in one protest. This happened to me when I was a teenager, you know, protesting the war in Iraq in 2002 and 2003. And the protest doesn't work, and you just think, oh wow, you know, and you're exhausted by this point, and you just think, okay, I quit. This doesn't make any sense. You know, I've learned so much from mentorship from you know, Christian activists who I think maybe because of their sense of original sin recognize that, you know, once right. you get into the work of social change, you're never going to get out. So you might as well do it in a way that's sustainable. You might as well do it in a way that has a kind of long-term horizon rather than just imagining you're going to drop in on the weekend and solve all the problems of the world and then get back to your life.
So it's right. There's a sense that we actually live in a fallen world rather than merely an imperfect society.
Yeah. And that this is a permanent state of being and not it's a marathon. It's not a sprint. I'm thinking of when I was a kid, it was the first boycotts I heard about were Nestle because of the selling of formula to in the developing world. And gosh, we thought we resolved that with the Nestle boycott. And of course, they're still selling formula in the developing world, and babies are being, drinking dirty water and infant formula. I guess the divestment effort against South Africa, the apartheid government, could be arguably a boycott that succeeded. But that was that was decades long of effort. So, you know, I guess to embrace this, it's something of a lifestyle, and it probably shouldn't be generated by personalities. Oh, I'm going to go boycott her or boycott him. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to make decisions about what I buy that reflect my values. I'm not going to buy clothing that's made by children for children. I'm not going to buy, you know, food that's exploiting the earth or exploiting farm workers. And that's difficult because you have to do some detective work and legwork in that regard.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. We're talking with Nathan Schneider, who is a columnist for America Magazine.
He's the author of Thank You Anarchy and God in Proof, those two books. And he's written a lot about social movements, about protest. And Nathan, I wonder if you saw Bishop McElroy of San Diego, the speech that he gave recently at the U.S. Regional meeting of the World Meeting of Popular Movements, in which he challenged organizers to disrupt and rebuild, which struck me as really interesting sort of terminology, because I think in a lot of ways that is what a lot of people who were supporting someone like Donald Trump or even Bernie Sanders were hoping to do with their votes.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I just wonder what that means. You know, what disrupt what and rebuild what? You know?
And, right.
I
mean,
that's a very legitimate question.
We'll be putting that to Bishop McElroy this week. So hopefully we'll have an answer for you.
It's still newsworthy, though, that a bishop is asking for the disruption of anything, right?
Yeah, it's interesting how that word disrupt has a kind of immediate appeal nowadays.
Yes.
You know, right.
I certainly see that in the tech world where I float around a lot. You know, people are just are always excited about what's the next thing that's going to disrupt. And, mm-hmm. and the question for me is always, wait, who are you disrupting and what's going to happen to them? You know, who they talk about disrupting industries, but people work in those industries. You know, what are we really talking about here?
Yeah. I spoke to union organizers 20 years ago or more, and this is already in a late era of deindustrialization, early 80s, and they were asking that question. They kept hearing about, we're not against progress. We're not against technological innovation and changing realities. But what happens to the people who are left behind when this happens? When we, you know, capitalism has the great expression of creative destruction. That mm-hmm. question was never answered. And here we are 30 years later, and in a lot of ways, that's what contributed to the Trump revolution in this last election. All those people who were left behind, that question was never answered for them, and we just kind of left them along the wayside of the global economy to molder and fend for themselves. And
yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that we need a different way of talking about and doing innovation. You know, I've been turning lately to there's very little in English by him, but the writings of Father José María Arizmendi Arrieta, who is the founder of Mondragon, the huge worker co-op in the Basque region. And you know, he's very interested in innovation. He's very interested in technology. He actually started the co-op out of a technical school that he also started. And but his vision is one grounded in that personalist ethic that was so important in Catholic thought in the middle of the 20th century, that also influenced the present Pope, and one in which technology serves the ends of human development rather than kind of constantly disrupting human beings trying to develop themselves and their communities.
Well, because what are the results of that? We see it. What did we start the show complaining about? Dealing with this problem, this crisis of migration. Well, a lot of that migration is economically generated. It's farmers losing the ability to have a local economy, to have a subsistence economy work for them. And they're driven into flight by poverty, by hopelessness, and that's it's all tied together. We didn't answer those questions for American manufacturing workers, and we never answered it for people in Central America and throughout the hemisphere who are moving because of hunger and the need for bread.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, I sound
so
like I'm ready to go to some
American.
Kind of battlement.
You're ready to disrupt.
I'm ready.
Do you see Pope Francis as a kind of disruptor or an activist in a sense, Nathan, or is that sort of not an accurate term?
I think of him, you know, maybe others would have a different view, but again, I think of him as actually modeling this other form, which is maybe rather than disrupt, innovation as connection. You know, innovation as a way of connecting stuff that we're not making connections that we haven't been making well enough so far. You know, the church previously had talked about economy, had talked about environment, had some relationships with social movements and so forth. In Laudato Si, he connects those together in a way where even, you know, the secular social activists I work with, you know, people like Naomi Klein are kind of blown away that, wow, he really made connections that we've been struggling to make for decades. You know, I think that's an alternative to the mode of disruption, of recognizing the resources that are around us and recognizing kind of new ways to recombine and connect them and create space for more possibilities to bloom. I think, unfortunately, for those who want to see a kind of narrower church, a smaller church, That feels like disruption because it's opening up doors for others to come in. But you know, I think there's also room in Francis's view for a kind of traditionalist strategy or a traditionalist culture, and I think it's a wonderful thing. I hope that it's a form of connection again, not just disruption.
And you touched on some of these themes in a piece we just published at AmericaMagazine.org called "Dear Mark Zuckerberg, Democracy is Not a Facebook Focus Group." It's actually a letter you wrote to kind of open letter to Mark Zuckerberg, which I encourage people to check out. It's right now trending, is the most popular article on our website. But I wonder, tell our listeners what you had to say to Mr. Zuckerberg.
And did he write back yet?
He hasn't written back. I've been having a kind of ongoing monologue in the pages of America with Mark Zuckerberg. If you look over my blog posts over the last couple of years, this is not the first. It's interesting. You know, he's someone who's at this incredible position of power in the global media right now, and he just last week came out with this nearly 6,000 word manifesto, for lack of a better word, articulating how he sees the challenges the world is facing and the role he imagines for Facebook in it. And he suggests something really interesting, which is that in a moment of an apparent decline of political democracy, you know, where a lot of countries around the world are starting to seemingly elect people with authoritarian tendencies, where actually polls suggest that democracy, people's perceptions of democracy have been on the decline for a number of years now. He suggests that maybe in this context, we can build a new kind of democracy in online platforms, in these global platforms that connect us across borders, you know, that can help recognize the truly transnational condition we're in and build democracy across these networks. Yet the democracy that he offers really ends up sounding like a pretty wimpy Facebook focus group, you know, something to help him improve his services. And you know, again, pointing to the long tradition of concern for ownership and distributed ownership in Catholic social teaching, I argue to him that if you're going to talk about democracy, you have to also democratize ownership, that just allowing people a little bit of input without also allowing them to take full responsibility for the platforms that they're engaging with, in this case Facebook, you're not going to get real democracy, that you have to have that ownership piece. That's something that, you know, goes back to Rerum Novarum and in the late 19th century and has been a consistent theme in Catholic social teaching sense.
Well, I think I just like a cut of my cut from the Facebook profits. I mean, I'm the product, right? It's being pitched and sold to advertisers and demographic entities. I should get a piece of the action.
It's an interesting thing because, you know, we tend to think of ourselves as customers of Facebook, you know, because we're right. Users and we're interacting with the platform. But that's absolutely right. Economically, we are the product being sold to the clients, to the advertisers, and in fact, we're also, in a sense,
we're content workers. Providers as well. Yeah, we're creating the content that they're using to draw more eyes to Facebook.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there's that calls for a different kind of arrangement.
Well, and it also seems to me that getting back to the earlier part of this conversation, that it would be almost impossible to have a successful boycott of Facebook because we'd be boycotting ourselves. Like we were refusing to buy ourselves.
We boycott Mark Zuckerberg. That's what we do. I don't know how to do that. The original Captain Boycott in Ireland was treated to, he was ostracized. That's how that was the form of the boycott took in Ireland when this term originated. He was a landlord who treated his people very poorly. This is what Hollywood teaches me, so I think it's true. Captain Boycott. Mm-hmm. It's a real person.
That's sounds real.
Hand to God. Captain Boycott is a real person, and he was just cut off from the society. People had nothing to do with him, and eventually he succumbed to the pressure of being so ostracized.
Interesting.
Well, this notion of the boycott is so important, and I think we should highlight this. You know, we talked earlier about the fatigue, the sense that, oh no, we're politicizing every, you know, the whole economy. LL Bean becomes political. All these things. You know, there is a sense in which I think that anxiety is right, but there's actually another vision that might enable us to approach this in a different way, and that's the vision of the civil economy tradition that comes out of the Italian Renaissance and is represented by economists today like Stefano Zamagni at the University of Bologna, and who was a major figure in developing the economic teachings coming out of the of Vatican in the last decade or two. And this is a view of the economy that isn't like ours, that what we tend to see in America or in the United States, right, where the economy is one thing and politics is another thing and they're totally separate. This is a view that sees economy as essentially moral, and that recognizes that the economy should be shaped by moral choices at all levels, and that it should interact with the political, with government, with civil society, with nonprofit organizations. That these things all play an interdependent and interrelated role, and that actually kind of gives us tools for not just thinking that. That the politicization of our choices in the economy is an interruption of the normal, but it actually maybe should be the normal, right. That we should always be thinking of ourselves as moral agents in what we buy.
And things can work towards creating relationship as opposed to just creating objects that are, or commodities that are moved around. And I'm thinking of, instead of boycotting, the boycotting efforts I've seen throughout my mm-hmm. life where you're making consumer choices.
Affirmative decisions.
Yeah, where, I'm not going to buy the chocolate that is generated by child slave labor in North Africa. I'm going to buy Divine Chocolate, and I'll even drop the name out there for you folks. Divine Chocolate, which is accessed by cooperative farms, where you learn about the people who are generating the product and what their lives are like. So a relationship is created.
Yeah, and I also think that there is, to your point, Nathan, that there is... We do need to have a moral consciousness and realize that our decision making, even in the most mundane of circumstances, has a moral dimension. But it's these important the symbols of our tradition, like original sin, are important because that is what can prevent our moral consciousness from making us moralistic, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that it's when this it just becomes a blunt instrument through which we continue to alienate and to create others, that I think is where the exhaustion comes in.
That's so right, and it comes back to that question of connection. You know, how can we rather than this drive to disrupt? We've seen so much of that, and we're feeling the effects so hard. You know,
that's right.
One way of thinking about activism going forward, is how are you making a connection? How are you forming new connections that weren't there before? How are you helping one another, helping us all see the solidarities that we could be having with one another that we're losing because some figurehead is dividing us?
That's right.
And I think that's the challenge that we face. I think that's what a kind of God of love, if we turn our attention to a God of love, that's what we're called to, much more than severing the ties that just keep getting severed over and over.
I gotta go, Nathan, but that's a great place to stop. And Nathan Schneider is a contributing writer for America. And he's the author of Thank You, Anarchy, and God and Proof. And you can check out all of his work at americamagazine.org, where you can also follow us on Twitter and on Facebook. I could listen to him all day. That's my problem.
You almost did.
And to subscribe to America, call 1-800-627-9533. That's 1-800-627-9533 for a smart Catholic take on faith and culture. For America This Week, I'm Father Matt Malone, along with Kerry Weber and Kevin Clark. Good day.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.